When you're diagnosed with AIDS, very often you lose your support system, you lose your families, you lose your job. I've lost the majority of friends that I had before my diagnosis.
I guess your life can't get any more focused when you know you're liable to die. I mean, that's pretty definite focus. But I would just like to make, you know, what time is left meaningful, and I think that's all that's important.
I miss being able to go to restaurants and go to a movie. I mean, I'm just not mobile enough to do that, and those things are still important. I want to work. You know, I want to go in my kitchen and cook.
They wouldn't even come into my room unless they absolutely had to. When they did, they wore masks, gowns, and gloves. Well, my mother said that God was punishing me for my lifestyle.
As the 1980s kicked off in San Francisco, America, individuals with an AIDS diagnosis faced deep stigma long before it reached the shores of the United Kingdom, revealing a reality of fear and misunderstanding alongside severe health issues and isolation. From these challenges arose activism, turning personal struggles into a call for awareness and change. Support for charities grew, fostering solidarity and hope. These stories of resilience highlight the human spirit's ability to confront adversity and build a compassionate community based on mutual support. So as we buckle up and take off, headed for San Francisco, we'll be introducing you to Bobby, Phil and Joe. These are their stories, in their voices, in their own words.
Right, some in-flight entertainment. Ooh, the HIV podcast. Go on then.
AIDS brings a response
fight
from the government.
AIDS, the disease which claims lives.
Welcome to AIDS, the Lost Voices, with your camp host, William Hampson.
And my fabulous co-host, Gloria.
Between us, we'll be looking back through the decades at how Britain reported on the AIDS pandemic.
And where we will try to unpick individual stories in the newspaper archives from the 80s, 90s and noughties.
Ready?
Ready.
Alright, let's do it.
Robert Thomas Reynolds, born in San Francisco, California in October 1946, emerged as a prominent figure in the fight against AIDS in those early years. Robert, or rather Bobby, worked in the customer service department of Pacific Gas and Electric Co. while becoming an AIDS advocate and a member of the Shanty Project's board of directors. Bobby utilized his personal experience as a person with AIDS to raise awareness and support for those affected by the epidemic. In a 1984 Shanty Project training video, Bobby candidly recounted the onset of his illness, detailing the first signs of Kaposi sarcoma that started to appear on his body.
I was born and raised in San Francisco at St. Francis Hospital, which they have torn down to make a parking lot. I read a lot of mysteries. I love to read. I like to cook. I do a lot of gardening. I've played on the softball team for Moby Dick for the last 3 years in the Gay Softball League. And for about 12 years now, I guess, I've been playing volleyball on weekends with an informal group that meets. And then, in June of 1982, things changed. Going back a little bit before that, one day in March, I was at work and I had crossed my legs and my socks had slid down and I saw this funny spot. And there was a part of me that knew exactly what it was. It's one of those KS lesions. But I couldn't allow myself to acknowledge that. I looked at my other ankle and there was one there too. So there was two things I couldn't acknowledge. So I stuffed that away. Every so often I'd get up the courage to look and they were still there. I guess it was in April of 82 that I finally got the courage to show my lover Mark. This funny flea bite that I had scratched, and look at this scab, it's still here, it hasn't gone away. 2 weeks later, I says, you know, that scab's still here, I wonder what it is. All this time ignoring and denying what I knew it was. Towards the end of May, we had planned on going up to the Russian River for a week's vacation, and I was having a little trouble with a chest cold or something. I get upper respiratory infections a lot. And so I decided I'd go into the doctor, and I called up and I said, Sunshine, which is what I call the nurse, I want to come in and see the doc, and I have this funny spot on my leg I'd like him to look at. And she says, oh, no. And I laughed and giggled and made a joke and then forget it. So I went in, and I remember out in the office before I went into the examining room, and I says, I'm going to show you something, but I don't want you to tell me what I think it is, because I didn't have any of the fun getting it that all those guys have done. The stereotypes, fast life livers, you know, fast lane. I can be pretty dull sometimes. I didn't think I'd earned all that. Well, he had a surprise for me. He had evidently, as a resident, worked with the classical Capices in older Mediterranean men and knew, just looking at it and touching it, that it was, and that's what he said. And I didn't want to hear that. So I left there thinking, well, he's wrong. And he'd scheduled me for a biopsy, and the next day I went to the dermatologist, and the dermatologist looked through those magnifying glass that's all lit up, and very professional. And he says, I think it's a blood blister. And I said, thank you very much, I'll take that. So he cut them off, and he said, don't go in the river for a few days, you might get some germs in there. And that was it. I went on vacation, ignoring it. When I come back, everything will be fine. Except there was one night, I think it might have been Tuesday of the next week. It was a full moon, and I stayed at my favorite place is the Willows. And they have a deck with a hot tub and wonderful flowers. And at that time, there were lots of petunias, purple and white ones. And I remember sitting there by myself in the hot tub and looking at the full moon and the stars and just how incredibly pretty and peaceful and calm. And you may have KS. No, I don't. That was it for the week. I came back to work on the next Monday, and I knew it was going to be good news. So when I called up, I called the doctor. I called up and I said, okay, give me the good news. And she says, just a minute, the doctor wants to talk to you. And I knew all along that he was going to tell me that it was positive. I can't remember much of what he said. I mean, I think the body defenses started kicking in right then. I started breathing heavy. I started shaking. I started tearing, although I wouldn't allow myself to cry. I got real watery. He said that somebody was going to call me. I do remember that. And I hung the phone up and I sat there for a minute and took a deep breath. And I wobbly pushed myself up and walked across the hall to my boss. And I said, Ted, they just told me I have cancer. What am I going to do? He stuck his hands in his pocket and looked at me. He says, oh, shit, Robert, I have no idea. Looking back on it, it was a real difficult day to go through. It felt like the roof had fallen around me and there was a lot of dust and I couldn't see very clearly. I couldn't focus. I'd find myself coming to having stared off into space. I was functioning like a robot, doing my work, answering the phones, being very polite and very matter of fact. I decided I wasn't going to tell anyone. I was going to be very strong. I especially wasn't going to tell Mark, and then I realized, well, that's real dumb, because he's going to know.
Mark Wood, has been in Bobby's life since 1978, where the pair first met when Bobby joined the Gay League softball team, Moby Dick. Mark, as the team's manager, admired Bobby's charisma and passion, making him a standout player and assisting in the coach of the team. Their bond evolved into a lasting romantic relationship, making it all the more harder for Bobby to share his AIDS diagnosis with the love of his life, Mark.
Gradually, I did go home and tell Mark, and I did tell a few people here and there. And it's hard doing that. It was real difficult to see the pain and the hurt. I don't think I'll ever forget his face when I told him. And as word got out, at that time it wasn't known as AIDS. It was the gay plague or the gay cancer. But at work, I just told them that I have cancer. And you know how big offices are. If they don't have rumors, they'll create them, right? Well, I ended up with leukemia, chest cancer. Did they say I was sick? I think somebody said I had a mastectomy even. I thought that was... I think that's a little overachieving. So there was that whole part where I felt compelled to touch bases with all the people that I knew and tell them personally.
It's perhaps one thing to be in a mutually loving relationship and for one half of that partnership to fall ill. As much as you love, cherish and support them, such circumstances can test the very foundation of that bond. However, when your partner is grappling with a condition such as AIDS that is transmissible and ultimately leads to a slow decline, the emotional burden becomes profoundly complex. And Bobby shares how his diagnosis was affecting his relationship with his partner, Mark.
When I was diagnosed, I think I mentioned that there were two things going on. I really wasn't feeling sexual, and I was also afraid of being sexual with Mark until I found out some more. I really didn't feel comfortable about having sex with him until he went and had some testing done, and he's healthy as a horse. And then it was like the dam burst, and I couldn't get enough. Wore the little kid out. Well, that went on for a while, and we did a lot of talking during that period, and we were still doing everything we did before. And I thought it was okay with him. My birthday is in October, and last year, one of the packages was very small. I like small packages, so I saved it for almost last. And when I opened it up, it was a box of rubbers. And I said something flippant and giggled and laughed, and inside I was hurting. He hadn't talked to me about his fear. Our next adjustment was that I wouldn't inseminate him in any way. And lately I find him pulling away and not wanting to have sex with me as often as I would like to. We'll play true confessions. I haven't talked to him about it. I'm afraid to. I'm afraid of that rejection. Long time in group, we'd talk about doing an ad in the personals column, and there was part of me that wanted to do it and part of me that just talked about it. And then one of the papers I saw was giving free ads, and I talked to somebody connected with the paper, and I said, would my confidentiality, could it be guaranteed if I put an ad in there? And you collected my mail and forwarded it on, and I finally wrote an ad. I think it was something like, person with AIDS would like to have safe sex. I want to be held and touched and made love to by a sensitive, caring man. Are you someone that can go through your fear and meet me on the other side? And that was a big step. I still haven't told Mark that I put that ad in the paper. I've gotten one response, and I don't know what I'm going to do with it. Crazy thing. It's like the person that I was this whole complete person where I could do things without having to worry. And now I'm this other person that has to be concerned all the time. I get real tired of it, you know? I connect with a lot of people that I would really like to do something with, and I'm afraid. I can't stand any more rejection. I just can't deal with that. And I also hunger. And how do you balance that out?
Within a matter of months from Bobby speaking there, Mark was also diagnosed with AIDS in April of 1985. And within the year, Mark Wood sadly passed away. San Francisco-based journalist Alan White, a gay man and a gay activist himself, later reported in one of his articles, in 1985, his lover Mark Wood was diagnosed with AIDS. B. Roman remembers, I watched Bobby take care of Mark for months. He would carry him from the chair to the bed, from the front of the TV to the table to eat. Another friend of the couple, Andrew Llewellyn, said, Bobby believed that Mark would be his Rock of Gibraltar. He expected Mark to be there for him when he died. I remember Bobby going in the backyard and screaming very loud. Who will I share my flowers with? Mark loved flowers, said Roman. In a TV documentary, Bobby remembers Mark, and we briefly get to hear from his partner Mark Wood in a piece of archived TV footage around the same time of his diagnosis in early 1985.
Mark. He had his good points and bad points, as we all do. He was a little arrogant. He was very strong-willed about certain things. But we had fun.
When Bobby was diagnosed in 1982, Mark was apparently healthy. But in April of 85, he too was diagnosed, struck by cancer and a debilitating paralysis. The disease progressed quickly in Mark.
And I truthfully admit that I miss being able to go to restaurants and go to a movie. I mean, I'm just not mobile enough to do that. And those things are still important. I want to work. You know, I want to go in my kitchen and cook. I want to be able to help him work in the backyard. And
when I tried to prepare myself as much as possible because I knew his death was inevitable, but you really can't. He went into respiratory failure, and he had done that twice before, so I called just automatically for the ambulance, the paramedics, but he was gone. He was the most important person in my life for a long time. And I think that says it all for anybody. No matter what your sexual preference is, you have somebody in your life that's the most important person. And that's who he was, is.
On the 16th of June, 1983, the Reno Gazette ran the headline, "Television crew shuns AIDS disease victims." Rather than me read the article, let's hear Bobby tell us how the story came about.
I went to the second National AIDS Conference in Denver, and I've been doing a lot of forums, educational type things, and I figured I'd touched a lot of lives and given information to people. And I came back from this national convention just really charged. You know, I'd talk to people from all over the country, and I'd raise their consciousness, and I'd sensitize them to the fact that we were people with AIDS, we're not victims, and we're only patients in a hospital setting. And I got a call through Shanti to come to a local TV station here for a morning talk show. And we would like to do a show about the fear and hysteria around AIDS. Great, I'm all primed, I'm ready. My friend Paul and I got there about 7:30 one morning, and we were shown to this little room, and a few minutes later the couple that was already in there was shown out. Then somebody came in and they were very, "Can we give you a cup of coffee? Can we get anything for you? Are you comfortable?" A few minutes after that, the producer of the show comes in, shuts the door, and says, "Geez, guys, I've got some bad news for you." Well, the scenario I created was that they could only use one of us instead of both of us, and that was fine because I'd let Paul go on. He was dressed better than I was. Well, in fact, the information he was bringing us was that the technicians on the stage refused to mic us, put this little contraption on us, come anywhere near us, or even have us walk onto the set. If we did do that, they had threatened a walkout, a strike, and they would take the whole crew with them. The show would be canceled for the day. Shock. I wasn't sure how to deal with it. My initial reaction was a four-letter word beginning with F, Y-O-U. If I can't be on the stage in person, then forget it. I'm not going to participate. Paul had had something similar happen to him a month or so beforehand. He was a veteran of rejection already. I guess because he had dealt with that before, what he told me was that, "Bobby, we've got to do it. You know, they talked about setting up a remote mic or a remote camera. We've got to do it, not just for us, but for all the other guys. We've got to do it and make our statement." I said, "Okay, we'll go with that." We ended up talking over a phone in the dressing room, watching people being made up and looking at the names on the lockers of all the stars of their newscast. And everybody was very solicitous. And they even gave us a free coffee cup with their name on it afterwards. I went home and we decided to make an issue of this, and we called a press conference. And all I could do was sit there and cry. I just had not experienced it in this. I mean, it just came at me. And all this love and thing that I was willing to give was coming back filled with hate. You know, I'd opened myself for love and I got hate. It was real hard.
And as Bobby shared, he and Paul relayed their appalling treatment to the press, with Paul's words resonating deeply in a Reno Gazette article. Quote, "I'm hurt and a little frightened about being isolated. I feel we're being shunned and put into a leper colony and kept away from the public. I don't like that. I really don't." Paul's sentiments underscore a profound sense of alienation that many faced during this dark chapter. It's crucial to acknowledge that this rejection extended beyond the broader society. Friends and families, too, often turned their backs on those affected by AIDS. Bobby's reflections reveal the painful reality of isolation that many endured by their friends and family, a reality that should never have been allowed to unfold.
Well, the last I heard, they expected that people with KS, which is what my diagnosis is, had an expected life of 4 to 5 years after initial diagnosis. I'm coming up on my third anniversary. I'd like to think that they're wrong and there's a lot of time left, but at the same time, I'm realistic that the odds aren't in my favor.
When you're diagnosed with AIDS, very often you lose your support system, you lose your families, you lose your job. I've lost the majority of friends that I had before my diagnosis.
My sister has been afraid. When I was first diagnosed, it took her 4 months before she came to see me. And then she got pregnant and couldn't see me at all. She had so much fear. Her husband was behind part of that, too. I know he's homophobic and has been since their whole married life. But what frustrated me was that she wasn't willing to listen to the doctors and nurses and read the information that I sent her that might have helped her deal with her fear. So she's continued to be fearful, and she's stuck 20 minutes away, and I'm here, and I haven't seen the twins, and we don't communicate very well. It's very likely that if you were a shit before your diagnosis, you're going to continue to be a shit after your diagnosis. You know, it's not this the hand of God coming down and touching your life sort of thing. It's given me an opportunity to look at my life and to look at who I am and to see what's most important to me in my life and the people that are most important to me. I've been able to sift through the bullshit to find ways to make myself happy, to find ways to smell the roses and to look at the sunsets and really, nature is so awesome. And when you allow yourself just the time to observe what wonderful things are around you, it's in a way, it's spiritual, and it could be God spiritual or life spiritual or the ego or I spiritual, but it's a very spiritual experience being able to look at who you are, what your meaning of life is, what your goals are, what this is all about, and it's an incredible journey.
In the 1986 documentary, Those People, Bobby reveals his sister's painful refusal to introduce him to his newborn twin nephews, no doubt rooted in the societal stigma of the time. The film contrasts both siblings' lives, showcasing Bobby's desire for family connection against his sister's fears, amplified by her husband's homophobia. This depiction emphasizes the emotional turmoil in family dynamics due to societal prejudice, highlighting the divide that occurred during the backdrop of the AIDS pandemic.
I told my brother before I got pregnant that, I wasn't sure how things would be between us. because I didn't want to take any chances with my kids. Every doctor I talked to said that I shouldn't have any contact with my brother because they just don't know.
The twins were born in San Francisco in 1984, a time when, here in the UK, we were just starting to grapple with the HIV/AIDS crisis, albeit slowly. However, in the UK by 1982, the routes of transmission were well documented. Yet, here we are in 1984 San Francisco, and the reality of the epidemic remains perplexingly distant for Bobby's sister. It's hard to fathom that Bobby's sister could be in San Francisco, a city notorious for its high HIV rates at the time, and still receives such an uninformed assessment from the doctors she claims to have consulted. Perhaps if she resided in the arse end of nowhere with a few reported cases, one might understand the lack of awareness. However, this is not the case. And her husband, whom Bobby noted was homophobic, sits beside her during the interview that she gives to the TV documentary, and this is what he, the husband, had to say.
It was the kind of thing, well, if nobody can tell us what's going on, then, what are you supposed to do?
Although they live just a few miles apart, Bobby and Susan have scarcely seen each other in the 2.5 years since her twin boys were born.
I told him that I would try and keep in touch with him on the phone, which I did.
Oh, I'm sorry, I've got to break away from Gloria's beautifully written script, but how can you try to keep in touch with someone on the phone? She's alluding that you can catch AIDS through a phone line, or, as Bobby said, she's being pressured or coerced, or perhaps it's her own views, to cut ties with her brother Bobby because of his sexuality, which then no doubt would have been due to his AIDS diagnosis. And then probably both, you know, it's a double whammy, so to speak. Okay, back to Gloria's script.
And every week it would be like he'd get a little cooler. And we finally just more or less cut off communications. He told me that it was like I had rejected him. And he just couldn't deal with it right now. And I couldn't do much about it because I figured, hey, you know, I'm pregnant. I'm not going to get pregnant again. I can't take any chances. I don't want anything to happen to my baby.
Bobby's feelings of rejection are palpable and deeply rooted in the revelations of his sister not wanting Bobby to be around her children, nor does she envision him taking on the role of uncle. Bobby's role as a member of the board of the Shanty Project, where he was filmed in a role play designed to illustrate the harsh realities faced by those living with AIDS, and to aid anybody who was taking on this counsellor training, compels him to confront his own vulnerabilities. As the exercise unfolds, Bobby's emotional turmoil becomes increasingly evident. He screams and punches the air in a moment of raw anguish that transcends the script. Incredibly sad to hear, and I want to apologise if you found it distressing, but I don't want to apologise because this is Bobby's reality. I'm probably going to say the same again because I'm going to go back to Gloria's beautifully written script. It is a visceral outpouring of pain, confirming that the hurt he embodied was far from rehearsed, revealing the intimate personal realities of his life that cannot be fully captured in mere performance.
Hundreds, if not thousands, of people have heard me speak and were able to look at AIDS through different eyes. And I have touched men in support group, and I have touched their families, and I have been able to help them find some ways of dealing. And you know, she's my sister.
He'd like Sue to be able to just jump and go. But
with three kids and Rod, I can't.
It's just not possible. I mean, it's family first, and unfortunately it's family too, but it's immediate family, and then it's the rest of the family.
Oh my gosh, please tell me you heard that.
I mean, it's family first, and unfortunately it's family too.
And again?
And unfortunately he's family too.
Unfortunately, he's family too. I mean, is this guy serious? What's so unfortunate about Bobby being not just family, but the brother, the only sibling of your wife? He's your brother-in-law, for fuck's sake. Oh, I don't know about you guys listening, but I don't just smell bullshit. I smell homophobia. Bobby mentioned it earlier. Gosh, it stinks, doesn't it?
I realized that they say casual contact, you probably wouldn't get AIDS, but they can't guarantee it. You know, as much as my mind says, hey, it's okay, my heart says, well, it may be okay, but I still don't know.
Oh, this woman is so confusing. So she's gone from being told by doctors to have nothing to do with her brother. Fast forward 2 years, now it's 1986 when she's giving this interview, and she now, quote, realises that you can't catch AIDS through casual contact, but she's sceptical. Bobby understood his sister and her husband, his brother-in-law, better than any of us. And when he made reference earlier to his brother-in-law's homophobia, it perhaps highlights how their comments here perhaps reinforce that point.
You know, I've never told my sister that she was wrong for being afraid, but some of her fears are irrational. And if she's going to continue being afraid, there's some day that I may die, and she will never have been able to cope with those fears.
There is no accounting for the work Bobby did in addressing AIDS and the stigma surrounding it. His frequent appearances in newspapers and on television transformed him into a recognisable face not only in San Francisco, but across the entire United States. The archives are vast, capturing his fierce advocacy at a time when silence was more commonplace. In his candid and brave discussions about his condition, he shed light on the realities of living with AIDS, often revealing the harsh toll it was taking on his health. In 1986, Bobby stood as a testament to resilience, challenging societal norms and igniting vital conversations that would resonate far beyond his own experience.
The beasties, all of us to some degree have the beasties. You wake up in the middle of the night and how am I going to make my mortgage payment? What am I going to say to my boss tomorrow? I really would like a raise and I don't know what to say. For me, it's fear. When am I going to die? Last Friday, I started noticing a difficulty swallowing. And it got progressively worse over the weekend to the point where I didn't want to eat. And then it became sort of painful all the time. So tomorrow morning, I have to go in for an endoscopy where they're going to insert a tube down my throat into my esophagus and stomach to see what might be going on.
Hi! Look at you! You're getting ready for the party.
I am.
The initial test results were a surprise and a relief. The pains appeared to stem from an ulcer.
Look great.
It's all I've been doing actually since I got over the shock of it was laughing. And when I call people to tell them that all the test results were negative and that they're treating me for an ulcer, they all say, oh, great, it's only an ulcer.
Dr. Mihalka was running further tests on Bobby Reynolds. His ulcers were not as benign as they appeared.
Well, actually, it did turn out to be herpes. We got a culture report back yesterday and started him on anti-herpes medicine in an oral form. It can be serious and it can spread to other areas, but the main part of this is it's associated usually with an incredible amount of pain and people are not able sometimes to even swallow their own saliva.
So here it is now, like a week and a half after that started, and I'm feeling pretty good. But I'm still having fevers at night, and I'm starting to have night sweats. What's next? So I'll live it, and I'll breathe it, and I'll eat it for so long, and then I'll say, break time, you know. Let's go blow bubbles. Let's go read a murder mystery, or let's just unplug the phone and forget about it. Luckily, I can do that. Living with AIDS these past 4 years has been an incredible experience. I treasure the lessons that I have learned.
Today, Bobby Reynolds is a rarity. The life expectancy of a person with AIDS is about 18 months. But chemotherapy successfully controlled his cancer. He has become a prominent advocate of the rights of people with AIDS, all the while mindful that, with his immune system damaged by the virus, his body is defenseless against any disease that may come along.
What is right now is that I'm doing pretty good. And what's possible is a lot. You know, there's a lot possible. So.
Bobby Reynolds continued his advocacy work, frequently appearing in the press and on television, despite facing numerous challenges, including societal stigma and the ignorance of many media outlets. His efforts brought attention to the plight of those affected by HIV/AIDS, a cause he championed passionately. However, by March 1987, despite having maintained an athlete's physique and dedicated healthy lifestyle, the Lansing State Journal revealed the harsh reality of Bobby's deteriorating health, stating, "The end does appear very near for Bobby Reynolds, who has survived the disease for 5 years, but is deteriorating rapidly. Reynolds is 40, but his shrunken body, faltering speech and feeble movements suggest a man twice that age." Now, this stark portrayal underscored the immense toll the disease had taken on Bobby, serving as a poignant reminder of the urgency and importance of his advocacy work. Despite the physical challenges, Bobby's spirit remained undeterred, exemplifying the resilience of those who continue to fight for awareness and compassion in the face of overwhelming odds. Sadly, just 5 weeks after that article, on the 27th of April 1987, Bobby Reynolds passed away, leaving a legacy of AIDS activism that sparked national tributes, where, on the 29th of April 1987, San Francisco's Oakland Tribune wrote, "Bobby Reynolds, who was an activist on behalf of AIDS victims and was among the first San Francisco residents found to have the disease, died Monday at home. He was 40. Less than 40 cases of acquired immune deficiency syndrome had been documented here when Reynolds was found to have it in June 1982. Reynolds went on national television and in 1985 spoke at San Francisco Opera, Ballet and Symphony Benefit for victims of the infectious viral disease that cripples the body's immune system. San Francisco is indebted to Bobby Reynolds," said Mayor Dianne Feinstein. "He lived for 5 years after he was diagnosed with AIDS and he used those years to help other victims and to increase his community's awareness of a new and dread disease." And to refer back to Alan White, the notable San Francisco journalist and gay activist, who documented Bobby's impactful work in a compelling obituary that resonated with the HIV/AIDS and gay community. He drew attention to Bobby's advocacy for individuals with AIDS, portraying a man dedicated to social justice and equality. The obituary celebrated Bobby's contributions while addressing his untimely death and the intimate moments shared with loved ones in his final days. Alan White wrote, "Bobby Reynolds passed at 2:50 a.m. Monday, April 27th. With him at the time were his shanty support person, Lynn Eubanks, his roommate Kirk Thomas, as well as Mary Russey, Holly Smith, Sandy Scott, and his 18-year-old dog, Miss Farkle. He had been in a sleep since the previous Thursday. He was 40 years old. A celebration of his life will be presented Friday, May the 8th at 7:30 p.m. And a week after Bobby's celebration of life, of which Bobby shared in a newspaper article he had meticulously planned a year earlier, the Seattle Gay News on the 15th of May 1987 also celebrated Bobby's achievements and contributions to the community, where the article reads, "Bobby Reynolds died after a 5-year struggle with AIDS. One of the first people to be diagnosed with the disease, Bobby was also one of the first people with AIDS to become politically active in fighting the disease and the misconceptions about it. Reynolds, a member of the Shanty Project's board of directors, was first diagnosed in March 1982. His activism around the disease began shortly thereafter. In June 1983, he helped to organise a national People with AIDS organisation. Also in 1983, he came to public attention when a technician for AM San Francisco refused to attach a microphone to him for a segment he'd been supposed to participate in. And on a trip to Washington that year, Reynolds spoke to press about AIDS from the steps of the Capitol. In October 1985, Reynolds was dealt a hard blow when his lover, Mark Wood, died of AIDS. His activism survived, however, and in June 1986, he walked in the lesbian gay pride with a huge contingent of people with AIDS and friends. There was a special celebration of his life Friday, May the 8th, at the First Unitarian Church, San Francisco. Donations may be made to the Shanty People with AIDS Fund, the San Francisco AIDS Foundation Food Bank, or the AIDS Home Care and Hospice Program. Oh, and it's clear from all that Bobby did that Bobby Reynolds was an absolute treasure, embodying integrity and resilience in all he pursued. While there was no mention of his immediate family, particularly his sister and nephews, one can only hope, in time, that they will look back and reflect on their uncle and brother with a sense of pride. Those who had the privilege to know and love Bobby are a testament to his achievements and the battle he fought, each accomplishment making a chapter in a life dedicated to making a difference. It is this legacy that endures, inspiring admiration and respect in all who remember him.
People's fears are real, but they may not understand what my lifestyle is like, but they understand that I'm a person, that I'm hurting, so that they don't send me off to hell just because I'm a gay man or just because I have AIDS.
Together, the citizens of San Francisco will continue making a difference. Together, my friends, together, for we are a family, and we are not alone. Keep looking for the rainbows. Thank you.
Bobby Reynolds, we salute you. Philip Shippey, best known as Phil, is filmed lying in a hospital bed in San Francisco's General Hospital in 1983. Phil's 27 years marked both by resilience and vulnerability amidst the AIDS crisis. When asked by the documentary filmmakers about his feelings regarding his recent AIDS diagnosis, Phil speaks candidly, revealing a mixture of fear, defiance, and even a touch of humour.
I was scared, but I've got a lot of friends around that kept me up.
Does your family know?
Yeah.
What's been their response?
Well, my mother said that God was punishing me for my lifestyle. So, and the rest of my family, I have 7 brothers and 3 sisters. I heard from 1 brother, but the rest of them, I haven't heard a word.
They all know?
Yeah.
And your father?
Yeah. He's, he feels the same way my mother does. So.
Has he contacted you?
He talked to me for a little bit. This was before they knew it was AIDS, so before I didn't actually tell them. I called my brother, and he told them.
How do you know that? Did your mother say to you she felt you were being punished?
Yeah.
Are they very religious?
Very.
That must hurt to have to hear that.
No, I knew. No. I've known him for a long time, so I knew. They want me to come home, and do what's right so I might be healed. Wrong.
When I listen to Phil and watch the footage of the documentary, it is remarkable how, despite his diagnosis at such a young age, that he retains an upbeat and jovial demeanour. The only thing I found truly infectious about Phil wasn't his HIV/AIDS diagnosis, but was his smile. As he recounts his experience, I found myself smiling in return because he just has this amazing energy that just comes through the screen and perhaps comes through his voice. Born Philip Eugene Shippey on the 1st of April 1956 in Weiser, Washington County, Idaho, to parents Samuel Shippey and Enid Brown, Phil grew up in a large family. Although the reasons for his move from Idaho to Elko, Nevada remain unclear, I cannot help but speculate from some of the things he alludes to, that it may be influenced, at least in part, by his openness about his sexuality, a subject he discusses candidly while being interviewed.
And I've been living in Elko, Nevada for 3.5 years.
How big is Elko?
About 20,000 people.
What age is there?
I worked for a distributor.
And you say that you raise horses? Or?
Yeah, raise Appaloosas for show.
Are you in a relationship at all?
Yeah, we've been together for 3.5 years.
I was curious about the gay community in Elko. Is there such a thing? Or
well, there was about seven of us. And there wasn't a bar we congregated at or anything. We just had dinner parties.
But you knew about AIDS and KS there?
Yeah.
How did you find out about that?
Newspaper. And, well, we discussed it a lot.
Just the regular newspaper or gay newspapers?
No.
The Elko newspaper.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Oh. It's even in there.
Well, you know, having about seven gay people in Elko, I mean, kind of dismisses the whole stereotype of people having multiple partners. You were in a relationship, and the fact that, you know...
I'm monogamous.
You've been in a monogamous relationship for 3.5 years.
So I caught it at least 4 years ago.
Wow.
Or came into contact with it, I guess. I should say.
So that's interesting. This one, I didn't know it had such a long gestation
period. I didn't either.
I thought 2 years was sort of dramatic.
Well, when the scare of AIDS first came out, you know, I was counting the months till I thought it was 3 years. And I counted the months, you know, till I was with him 3 years. And after that, I felt safe. You know, if it does take up to 5 years, can take up to 5 years, there's probably a lot of people that are walking around out there that...
Phil recounted how he and his partner had settled in Elko, Nevada. However, in 1983, the joy of their new life was abruptly overshadowed by Phil's sudden illness, which his doctors suspected was AIDS. Phil goes on to describe his hospital experience in Elko, where there appears to be an underlying sense of fear and ignorance by the staff regarding the disease, and perhaps Phil's sexuality.
How can you compare the healthcare here at San Francisco General in Ward 5B with where you
at the Elko?
Yeah.
Well, in Elko, they wouldn't even come into my room unless they absolutely had to. When they did, they wore masks, gowns, and gloves. They just really had a bad attitude. You know, and here, it's incredible.
Having researched and explored San Francisco's Ward B, which was a dedicated AIDS ward at their general hospital, as articulated by Phil in 1983, uncovers striking parallels with London's Broderick Ward, which was established 4 years later in 1987. Both wards sought to cultivate a compassionate and empowering environment for AIDS patients, emphasised by casual nursing attire and a focus on patient autonomy. This progressive approach was particularly significant for HIV/AIDS patients grappling with common AIDS-related conditions such as pneumocystis pneumonia, sometimes referred to as PCP, and Kaposi sarcoma. Also, the psychological resilience developed in the face of the epidemic's stigma was remarkable, as illustrated by Bobby Reynolds earlier, who noted that his diagnosis fortified his resolve and rendered him a stronger individual. Phil similarly highlights the same with the TV crew, revealing how these adversities fostered a deeper sense of self and community amidst the struggles they faced.
Has this changed you in any other ways? I mean, just your outlook on life in general, priorities?
Well, for one thing, it sure made a lot stronger person. You know, I've found strength that I never knew existed. You know, I broke down and cried when I first heard it, but since then I think I'm going to beat this disease. You know, I really do. And all my friends do. They've got a feeling. I've got a feeling. And I'm determined to beat it.
Phil Shippey's interview here in 1983 was short, much like his life, which came to an untimely end just a year later on the 10th of October 1984. At the age of 28. His passing in Santa Rosa, Sonoma County, California, 55 miles north of San Francisco, marked a significant loss not just for his partner, but his friends too. Despite his family's religious views on his sexuality and his AIDS diagnosis, they returned his body to Idaho for burial. In remembrance of Phil, his friends honored his memory with a panel on the AIDS quilt, poignant tribute to those lost during a challenging era. The documentary, Time for Change, which featured Phil alongside other courageous individuals from the San Francisco area, aired in 1986, 2 years after his death, highlighting the struggles and resilience of many affected by the AIDS pandemic.
For one thing, it sure made a lot stronger person. You know, I've found strength that I never knew existed.
I guess your life can't get any more focused when you know you're liable to die. I mean, that's pretty definite focus.
Meet Joseph Schwartz, a compelling figure who also featured alongside Phil Shippey in the documentary Time for Change that was filmed in San Francisco in 1983, yet didn't air until 3 years later in 1986. At the time of filming, Joe was 39 years old. However, his appearance and demeanour suggested a man who was well into his 60s or 70s. Joe's voice carries a weight of experience that belies his age, encapsulating the heartache and resilience that defined an era overshadowed by fear and loss. Joseph Winston Schwartz, best known as Joe, was born on the 14th of June 1943 in Alliance, Ohio, to parents Fred Schwartz and Catherine Oswald. Joe attended the Alliance High School in Ohio and was an accomplished pianist and a very handsome chap. Between Joe filming in 1983 and the documentary airing in 1986, Joe appeared in San Francisco's Oakland Tribune on the 29th of May 1984. Under a photograph of Joe sat at his baby grand piano, the headline reads, "Rising Above the AIDS Tragedy," and the article states, "Joseph Schwartz spends a lot of time at the piano these days. He plays the baby grand in the living room of his San Francisco Diamond Heights apartment, or his treasured Steinway grand in the downstairs study, letting loose with moving interpretations of Chopin's Preludes and Beethoven's Moonlight Sonata. Sometimes his own compositions neatly take shape on the music stand. But Schwartz, 40, doesn't leave his apartment with its splendid view of the San Francisco skyline very often anymore. He has been ill since March 1983, first with pneumocystis pneumonia, then with Kaposi sarcoma, a form of skin cancer, followed by complications from chemotherapy. Now he has diabetes and has spent time in hospital every month this year. That is the worst part about having AIDS," said Schwartz, who has acquired immune deficiency syndrome, an incurable disease that robs the body of its ability to fight infection. "You realise you're not going to be whole again," said Schwartz. But Schwartz said he has come to terms with his illness and he draws on his own experiences to help other people through his work as grant administrator with the San Francisco AIDS Fund, an organisation that provides emergency financial assistance to persons with AIDS. "When he first became ill last year, Schwartz spent 5 weeks and 2 days in the hospital and had to take a disability leave from his job in sales with American Telephone and Telegraph Company. I didn't see anyone. I didn't want to. I didn't seek counselling," he said. He felt isolated, dispirited, living a life with no routine. And to break away from the article for a moment, Joe goes on to share in the documentary how he accepted the offer to become a roommate with Danny and Bill within a home they searched and found together. This pivotal moment unfolded at the Shanty Project, where Danny, who was deeply involved in volunteering, providing counselling and vital support to individuals living with AIDS or affected by HIV/AIDS. And it was through an encounter at Shanty where their shared values emerged that Danny and Bill extended the invitation to Joe, recognising a kindred spirit in him. The decision not only changed Joe's living situation but also enriched their collective journey, and here's Joe to tell us more.
"And when Danny mentioned to me that he and Bill had talked about becoming a roommate with them, I just thought it was incredible. And yet I thought, well, now wait a minute, that's just how it all works, it seems. It's just part of the big plan. And it came to pass. I mean, it happened. I couldn't believe it. But every once in a while I have to remind them that, you know, something's wrong, folks, and bear with me. Hold me up when I need it, because I mean, there are times when you do need it. And as proof, I guess, for myself, that more proof anyway, that God's very gracious and very merciful, is the fact that I'm surrounded with two of the most loving people. At a time when I thought I was really going to end up very much alone, because there were a couple of times when I was living out at the beach apartment that I thought it would be very easy just to put myself to sleep. And I hadn't had many thoughts like that.
How did you come to know Joe?
Well, through Dan, basically. He's been involved in the shanty program, and when he mentioned the fact that he thought he'd like to have Joseph live with us, we started making the arrangements, and we decided to move out of the other apartment and find a bigger house so that we'd all have plenty of room to live together.
Oh, Bill and Danny sound amazing. Where solidarity and support within pockets of the community, where compassion triumphed over fear, fostering an environment that encouraged understanding and acceptance during such a dire time. And the 1984 interview that Joe gave to the Oakland Tribune continues. A letter from the AIDS Fund inviting him, Joe, to a four-day all-expenses-paid retreat on the Russian River changed all that. Dr. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross was the featured speaker addressing the seminar titled Life, Death and Transition. The experience flipped my life inside out, Schwartz remarked. Working with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross was like being in the presence of Gandhi or Mother Teresa. She made us look at the question, does it matter what we do with our lives in the time left to us? One of the decisions Schwartz made after the retreat, which was financed by the AIDS Fund and private contributors, was to start giving back. He wrote a euphoric letter to the AIDS Fund board and asked what he could do to help. Today, he is on the board of the San Francisco all-volunteer organization. Working from home in his apartment, Schwartz talks to people with AIDS who need emergency fund for groceries, rent, transportation and temporary living expenses. He uses a questionnaire asking them for the name of their doctor, their date of diagnosis and their current income. He also encourages them to talk about their feelings.
And I'm on the executive board of directors for the AIDS Fund. That's something else that has happened since we last saw each other. And I handle the welfare or grant part of that work. When people call us and they need money for food or need a month's rent or whatever, then we dispense those funds to the people. We do it directly. We have no red tape involved. The check goes out in the mail, you know, usually that day or the next day, and they've got it. The only prerequisite or whatever is that they be an AIDS patient. And when you talk to a potential grant person, you know, they can rip your guts out with the stories they tell you. You know, like AIDS for some people has made beggars out of them.
And Joe's interview to the Oakland Tribune continues. Getting involved with the AIDS Fund was just the thing I needed, said Schwartz. He became friends with other people with AIDS through the workshop and his volunteer activities, and he learned to go on living. He considers himself fortunate compared to many of the people he talks to. Before his illness, he had never really been active in the gay community. I was a homebody. I was not into the bar scene, he said. I've been down on Castro Street more since I've been sick than I ever was before. Now he has a large support network and he is able to create bonds with others seeking help. The thing that rips my heart out is recalling that one person said to me, AIDS has made a beggar out of me. This is not a city to be on the streets with no money. A lot of people have lost everything. Getting AIDS was a way of bringing an active life to a screeching halt, said Schwartz. Many people in the gay community are self-employed or have jobs without benefits. Many are thousands of miles from their families. Often they hope they die and get it all over with, he said. Sometimes I wonder what kills people first, the disease or the anxiety. Even though there are remissions, the course of the illness can be relentless. You go into hospital to cure one thing and you come down with another, he said. Normal sleep seems to go. There are night sweats that never seem to stop. Since Schwartz first became ill, he estimates his hospital bills have approached $80,000. His disability benefits from AT&T have run out. Sometimes his insurance checks are late, and the Social Security payments he applied for 3 months ago have not yet arrived. I'm very glad my parents are not alive, he said, his eyes filling with tears. I wouldn't want them to have known about this. But Schwartz said he's not bitter. I haven't lost my faith, otherwise I wouldn't be sitting here. I would have jumped off the bridge. There are things to do, books I want to read, pieces of music I want to write. Schwartz now considers himself at peace. He said he's one of the lucky ones living with two roommates in a beautiful apartment. He said he's not angry about his own illness, only about the suffering of others. Since January, he has lost 7 friends to AIDS. 3 of them were in the workshop with Kubler-Ross. Losing his friends makes him feel helpless, but he doesn't allow that helplessness to paralyze him. He has been studying Egyptology, talking to an Orthodox rabbi about his Jewish heritage, and examining Eastern philosophy. I take an Eastern view of my life, he said. I have a disease that will end my life prematurely, but I see it as a great plus. I see a chance to live better and to die a holy death that will give meaning to the people who will survive.
I don't think I'm afraid of dying. I don't enjoy the painful aspect of it. And I think the perversity of the AIDS illness is that it just doesn't seem to hit you with one big thing that puts you in a bed for 3 weeks and you die. It seems to just eat away at you, and a lot of AIDS patients die that way. I wouldn't tell anybody I want to die, but I would just like to make, you know, what time is left meaningful, and I think that's all that's important.
Joseph Winston Schwartz sadly passed away on the 11th of June 1985, aged 41, in San Francisco, just 3 days short of his 42nd birthday. Joe was cremated and laid to rest in San Francisco. Despite living with AIDS himself, Joe's dedication to the San Francisco AIDS Fund profoundly impacted the lives of many in need. He was more than just a voice on the phone, dispensing much-needed funds to those facing hardship. He offered a compassionate ear, an understanding heart, and a wealth of experience that only someone walking in the same path could provide. His gentle nature and empathy made him a beacon of hope for countless individuals grappling with the emotional and financial burden of their AIDS diagnosis. Joe's ability to relate to their struggles allowed him to foster a sense of community and support, ensuring that no one felt alone in their fight. And due to the unwavering companionship of Bill and Danny, Joe too did not spend his final years with his diagnosis alone. Their steadfast presence provided Joe with a comforting anchor, enriching his spirit with their camaraderie and support. Bill and Danny ensured that Joe felt loved and valued, reminding Joe that even in the darkest times, friendship could illuminate the path ahead.
And if you get afraid again,
they may not understand what my lifestyle is like, but they understand that I'm a person, that I'm hurting, so that they don't send me off to hell just because I'm a gay man or just because I have AIDS.
But I've got a lot of friends around that kept me up. For one thing, it sure made a lot stronger person. You know, I've found strength that I never knew existed. I think I'm going to beat this disease. You know, I really do. And all my friends do. They've got a feeling. I've got a feeling. And I'm determined to beat it.
As proof, I guess, for myself, that more proof anyway, that God's very gracious and very merciful, is the fact that I'm surrounded with two of the most loving people. But I would just like to make, you know, what time is left meaningful, and I think that's all that's important.
Together, the citizens of San Francisco will continue making a difference. Together, together, my friends, together. For we are a family, and we are not alone. Keep looking for the rainbows.
All of the actual newspaper articles mentioned in this serving are available on the Extra Tea blog. You can find the link below in the show notes. If you've enjoyed listening to AIDS, The Lost Voices, then don't be a shady bitch and show us some love with
a big fat like,
a comment,
a share, as in the link, not as in do you believe in life after love? Oh.
And for fuck's sake, don't forget to
subscribe and follow.